Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. In this episode, we're going to be hearing from Trava Carlson, a PhD candidate in philosophy at the Institute for Christian Studies and the Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. Trava will be sharing some of the context for a paper that he recently presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Trava's paper was Reveiling the Secret, Reading the Ransom Trilogy as Spiritual Exercise. Given that the focus of this show is Lewis's science fiction trilogy, you may want to have a revisit of the episodes that we recorded with Professor Alistair McGrath on these books, Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. I'll make sure that I include links to these shows in the show notes. Trava, is there anything else we need to know about before we hear your paper? Presumably, we need to have read the Ransom Trilogy in order to follow some of your thinking in this paper.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and at the beginning of my paper, I say that spiritual exercise is not so much being an expert in the Middle Ages or in Plato. I use a lot of Plato. I don't think that Lewis was necessarily as Platonist as I make him out to be. Which you'll hear when you listen to the paper. What I'm trying to do is root some of these spiritual exercises that Lewis uses in Plato's usage of them to point out how he's participating in that tradition. What I would say is to not be, you know, in your sense of appreciating the work as I do of Michael Ward or Jason Baxter or James Como or so many others out there who are just so knowledgeable and have such a high degree of expertise and encyclopedic level of knowledge that we can appreciate these texts with the knowledge and context that you have as a reader and that one brings to one's experience of the text. And so as far as appreciating it, what I want to say is, as far as what I say in the paper goes, hopefully the readers or the listeners of this podcast will have read the Ransom Trilogy. And if not, I highly encourage it. It's a delightful set of stories to enjoy over weekends and evenings. And then once they've read it once, if perhaps they'll listen to the sessions that Alistair McIntyre has or my paper or other books on it, what that does is just enrich the understanding. But that in reading it multiple times, even without that other context, things of the text will stand out to readers and will call to mind certain things in one's life that you've experienced in the past or you've seen or something that makes you even emotionally stir in a certain way whether it's a negative feeling or a positive feeling or a reaction or anger or excitement or a sense of wonder. These are all things that Lewis is trying to evoke. So I would say, especially in the second time one's going through the text, one should focus on what is arising in your memory and emotionally, and pay attention to those, sit with those. If it's a certain image that is coming up and causing that, to stop and linger with that image, repeat reading the image, picture it in your mind. These are the things that Lewis is trying to do. So I think the biggest thing to know before going into my paper is that's what I'm really trying to emphasize. That's what I'm trying to encourage. And by using images from the Middle Ages and from Plato, I'm trying to show what's under the hood, as it were, to use an analogy with a car, to show you what is working in the technology of the text, all of its gears, its mechanisms, its pipes, its all the different ways that it causes, what makes it work to flow. And I'm trying to encourage both scholars and people who are researching independently or just trying to get to know Lewis better, that the texts are worth reading in that way, and that they do have a big oomph in them that allows them to do that sort of work. So I would say, don't be discouraged by all of this, the if there's technical language or the expert research that other scholars are doing. But rather be encouraged by it, let your sense of wonder increase, and use those to encourage whatever insights you have, and then to share those with others, as I think that's what Lewis would have wanted.
That's really helpful. Well, let's have a listen to your paper. This is Travers' paper, Reveiling the Secret, Reading the Ransom Trilogy as Spiritual Exercise, which was given at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference held at George Fox University.
C.S. Lewis, in a 1943 letter to another author, E.R. Edison, exclaims that the first edition publishers of Paralandra blab out my whole theme in the blurb, which was meant to come over the reader by stealth. The phrase, come over, is heavy with implication. Note that Lewis does not say that the reader was meant to learn or comprehend the theme. There are two important things here. First, how the reader encounters and relates with the text. In other words, what the text does to the reader who is open to it. Second, in the text work is by stealth. Ransom makes the aim for Out of the Silent Planet clear in chapter 22, that readers developed an intuitive sense of heaven and prefer it over space. In the discarded image, the term heavens is associated with the ordered cosmos of the Middle Ages that mediates God's light to all creation. Since the light is invisible, while one can pick up on its presence emotionally, one must train the imagination to interpret the visible signs that point to it for one to become familiar with it. With that aim in mind, I argue that the trilogy participates in the long history of philosophy as spiritual exercise. In the book, Philosophy as a Way of Life, Pierre Hadot argues that this philosophy aims to train people to live and look in the world trains people to live and look at the world in a new way. To achieve such a transformation, the text must inculcate an awareness in the reader of right relationship within the cosmic order, and train the reader's imagination to notice the light that moves in the cosmos, which points to its source. When images work as veils in the text, they announce what they conceal and pull on the reader's desire to plumb their depths. I will show how Out of the Silent Planet trains the reader's imagination by participating in Ransom's journey. Two aesthetic implications follow. First, the cosmos is a primary actor in the text. Second, the mediatory role of the cosmos in Out of the Silent Planet will suggest the trilogy's coherence. Philosophy as Spiritual Exercise emphasizes how one reads rather than what one reads. The content serves the aim of the training. In what follows, I draw from Plato and medieval rhetoric. Although these are enriching, they are not necessary.
reading these texts as philosophy is a response to their invitation to make the journey one's own experience. With beauty or difficulty, pause and reflect. Finally, repeat the journey at least twice, once for exposure, twice for meaning. In Out of the Silent Planet, chapter 22 and the postscript present two tools for interpretation for the Middle Ages. The first tool is at the beginning of chapter 22, where the narrator reports that Dr. Ransom soon abandoned the idea of his Malachandrian dictionary. If we unfold this as an allusive image, two avenues emerge. First, the practice of allusive creativity with words in the Middle Ages called etymology, and second, the limit of a word's function as a sign. The modern dictionary comes from pre-modern texts that were more than a storehouse for language. In the Middle Ages, etymology is a practice of allusive creativity that reassembles words with different syllables, similar in look or sound. Isidore of Seville, a 6th century bishop and scholar, begins his book Etymologies, saying that the word disciplina, education, comes from studying, discendo, and something that is learned as a whole, discitur plena. Mary Carruthers, in The Craft of Thought, explains that these are not two competing explanations, but two starting points from one word to unfold more meaning by connections, like allegory does. Within the context of etymology, the trilogy's images become tools that the imagination can use to help reason understand the world in new ways by creating connections. So too, etymology requires the practitioner's wisdom to discern whether these new meanings draw us toward the good or whether they lead us astray. Even so, words have a limit. Ransom cannot create a dictionary because people on earth are unfamiliar with what the words point to. He explains, "What we have need for the moment is not so much a body of belief as a body of people familiarized with certain ideas. A word as sign reminds us to remember what it points to. So, without training the imagination to perceive the dance of life in the cosmos, a definition would be conceptual knowledge, not an intuitive sense of just sentiment in the chest or heart, like Lewis argues in The Abolition of Man." This leads to why Ransom concedes that the narrator should write a story as the better way to familiarize people with heaven or the ordered cosmos teeming with life. The second tool from the Middle Ages is the function of a word or sign as a veil. In the postscript, a letter from Ransom to the narrator wrestles with conveying his experience. "We are giving our readers a mere caricature of the Malachandrian language." He laments the failure of words to get across the smells and great hollow hound-like music in Malachandra. These images come with a homesickness, a longing for Malachandra. When Ransom declares the words a mere caricature, he warns us not to stop at the literal level or pass over the emotions that arise. A caricature is an image that clearly does not claim to represent what it points to through correspondence. If the literal level of Out of the Silent Planet is a caricature, then it is an invitation to hold on to what the whole story, its words and images, stir in the reader at the emotional level. In Lewis's sermon, Transposition, he explains that certain emotional and physiological reactions to aesthetic experiences like music are a response to the invisible reality that intertwines the visible. The sign acts like a veil. It must cover what it points to because one couldn't possibly express it with descriptive language. When one perceives a word or image as a sign that points beyond itself, Lewis explains that in the sign, the thing signified is really in a certain mode present. When the imagination follows the trace in the soul where the sign points, the result bubbles up into the emotions. This is a sign's intentio in the medieval rhetoric. With these signs, Ransom aims to inculcate in the reader a longing for what the smell and music of Malachandra point to. Michael Ward in Planet Narnia explains that the images of trees and woods in Out of the Silent Planet are associated with Mars or Malachandra. The smell in the woods as a sign points to Mars. Which god is a veil that conceals and points to what lies beyond? While Ransom prepares to hunt for the Hnakra, he reflects that, perhaps too, there was something in the air which had begun to work a change in him. The air and Ross's music cultivate a longing in Ransom. Ward notes that air and atmosphere in Lewis's works relate to a sentimental or preconscious way of relating to the world. In the discarded image, Lewis says that each model of the cosmos has a taste. The smell that wafts in the woods is the Martian wisdom that saturates the existence of that which shares in it. The taste of Malacandra's flavor is its Martian wisdom, which becomes evident in the Hnakra hunt. So two layers exist in the smell: the participation in the Martian wisdom and an indelible mark on the sentiment that makes the soul long for that air. Ransom's aim for the text, he explains, is to make present the intuitive understanding of the cosmos as teeming with life. He wants the reader to be familiar with the heavens. This is the enchantment that the text images or signs as veils cover, yet point out to the imagination. Ward argues that the planet Malacandra is not merely the setting of the drama, it is an actor of sorts in the drama. According to Lewis, in the discarded image, divine light flows through the cosmos, making existence visible. One traces this light by looking along the beam to its source, God. Eldilla, themselves light, are just below visible existence and mediate Mileldil's light. These images of air, light, and woods form a ductus, or channel, that allows the reader to flow with the direction of these images in the text, driven by what arises emotionally. The cosmos acts on Ransom's soul as it mediates Mileldil's light, which prompts Ransom's soul to mature in cooperation with his desire or will. Mileldil's movement stirs the forest's aroma, while the Hrosses chant echo this harmony. As St. Augustine reflects on Psalm 99, creation cried out, he made us. My question was the attention I gave them, and their response was their beauty. This cosmic mediation of divine light invites the soul to imitate the images of the harmony in the cosmos itself, and so blossom in maturity. With the tools of etymology, inviting allusive creativity in the word as veil, announcing what it conceals, I will read the middle so-called scrappy chapters, 11 through 16, and Out of the Silent Planet to show that they work on the reader's soul, how they work on the reader's soul. To do this, I bring attention to the images in the text as veils, and so reveal them or reveal them to disclose their meaning through allusive connections. The result of this is an imagination that notices where light glistens in the cosmos and desires to follow its trace. In other words, re-enchantment. The spiritual practice is the mediation on physis, or the nature of things. This trains the imagination to attend to a thing's unique mystery and unfold its relations in the ordered cosmos. When Ransom distinguishes types of visible forms, he meditates on physis in the visible world. In ancient philosophy, this permits one to perceive something in its relationship to the good, since every visible sign has an eternal form. For Plato, the well-ordered city has a harmony whose order imitates the harmonious movement of the heavens. When Ransom prepares for the hunt, he attributes the transformation that manifests in virtue both to the smell of Malacandra and the Hrosses village. His familiarization with the environment and the well-ordered city order his soul to the good by their impressions as Ransom journeys through them. Ransom's meditation on physis is evident in two places. First, with the bodies of the Hrossa, and second, in the vocations of Malacandra's inhabitants, the Fifiltrigi, Hrossa, and Sironi. Early in his stay with the Hrossa, the first opportunity to become familiar with the nature of the Hrossa as symbols of right relation begins with the Hrossa's bodies as visible signs. Ransom knew a male from a female Hross at sight, and even individual differences were becoming plain. His earlier impressions, shaped by distinguishing appearances, were all gradually being corrected. This reflects Plato's theory of perception and learning echoed by St. Augustine. A visible image makes an impression on the soul that prompts the soul to remember the nature of that image. For St. Augustine, remembering requires one to be familiar with that nature. Meditation on order in the visible world prompts the soul to imitate that order in the soul's own nature. Ransom learns that Hrosa are Malacandra's poets. In the central Middle Ages, poetry becomes an organizing discipline integrating music and grammar. Moreover, poetry entices the order of the soul through beauty to imitate the measured harmony that it derives from ratios in the cosmos. The tour through the well-ordered city then situates the Hrosa as poets relative to the roles of Fifiltrigi and Sironi. Nora, the guide of the dialogue on social roles, explains that one intelligent species on Malacandra does not rule over another. Their social order is a sign of right relation and mutual good.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis to receive your special teaser. Thank you. This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis to receive your special teaser. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
Lewis says in The Discarded Image that according to Pseudo-Dionysius, the social order is a triad of mediation between God, angels, and humankind, and it is analogous to that of intellect, imagination, and the senses. The Sironi, who live at the border of air and ether, where stars shine at midday, actualize the role of reason. Hrosa, as poets, unite intellect and sense in the ordered imagination. The Fifiltrigi, the crafters, are a veil of techne in right relation. They craft for the intrinsic good of beauty, and only most reluctantly for an external end, like when the Sironi commissioned a breathing apparatus. Through this tour of the well-ordered city, Ransom's imagination trains to encounter the visible world as signs, and his intellect traces where they point, becoming familiar with their meaning. Ransom's imagination is on the cusp of perceiving the invisible at the end of chapter 11. A young Ross, Greeky, tries to point out an eldil to Ransom, though he cannot see it. Ransom concludes that Greeky is pretending like human children do. However, through this imaginative exercise, Hriki's vision intertwines visible and invisible reality. The first trial that shows the maturation of Ransom's soul is the Hnakra hunt, when the harmony of his soul regulates courage with humility. To reach this point, his soul had to navigate the well-ordered city in chapter 11 and the dialectical dialogue on death and life and the visible and invisible with Huoi in chapter 12. The journey enables Ransom to ascend to reason through imagination. His maturity is tested twice, first before the Hnakra hunt in chapter 13, and second during his ascent to the Sorn in chapter 14. At the start of chapter 13, Ransom's imagination matures, reflecting the wisdom or taste of Mars that Ransom becomes familiar with in Ross's village. The invisible manifests as visible when the air, something invisible, becomes a sign for Ransom together with the society of the Hrasa. Perhaps, too, there was something in the air that he now breathed, or in the society of the Hrasa, which had begun to work a change. As Ransom's courage swells toward pride before the action, the wisdom he participates in moves his soul to impose humility on the newly risen riot of his feelings. After the hunt, Ransom's imagination perceives the Eldil, and he participates in the invisible like Hrasa do. He realized that a very little difference in his ear would have made the Eldil as inaudible to him as it was invisible. During Ransom's ascent to the Sorn in chapter 14, a second trial tests his soul's maturity. When he climbs, the light intensifies, the landscape appears wild and empty, and Ransom feels isolated, being outside of relationship, with a desolating force. This inverts his earlier disdain for space, which he once called a blasphemous libel. The landscape becomes an empty desert, a place of spiritual trial where only the visible exists. Ransom doubts the reality of his experience. He doubts his desire for duty, calling it fantastic to have thought that he had duties to such hobgoblins, if they were not hallucinations. Fantastic shares an etymology with the ancient Greek word phantasma, meaning image or illusion. While Ransom's intellect wrestles in the desert, his soul's maturity regulates the spirit of Acadia, or desolation, with courage. But all this time, the old resolution taken when he could still think was driving him up the road. The cause of Ransom's wandering intellect becomes evident. Ransom's imagination elusively connects the landscape as it appears with his mental picture of a lunar landscape. He realizes a little farther up that he is at the border of air. There was very little air above him. He was at the near of it, or he was at the end of it. The domain of Luna is the border where air transitions to ether, and Luna causes wandering of the wits. His ascent brings him into the intellectual brilliance, having prepared him to encounter the pure light of Nileldil. In these chapters with Hrasa and Ogre as his guides, Ransom imaginations trains him to perceive the invisible reality that intertwines the visible. He becomes familiar with the dance of the cosmos. Identifying the cosmos as a primary actor invites the consideration that both sidelighting Ransom and the hideous strength and the environment's mediation of the planetary intelligences in all three novels cohere with the whole. They invite the reader to look for the twinkling light and listen for the deep music, even in the darkest and most silent places. Thank you.
That was Trava Carlson's paper, Reveiling the Secret, Reading the Ransom Trilogy as Spiritual Exercise, which was given at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference held at George Fox University. Trava, one of the questions that struck me when I was listening to your paper, it's a really small thing, but you mentioned that chapters 11 to 16 in Out of the Silent Planet are called the scrappy chapters. Do you know why that is? And why are they called scrappy chapters?
Yeah, that phrase was actually, it just made me smile. I think Lewis scholars pick up from spending so much time with Lewis, his sort of cheekiness, as it were, is part of his personality. I believe it's John Lobdell, if I'm saying his name right, and it's in another collection of essays, and I can't remember the title off the top of my head, which is unfortunate. It's a book published by the University of Minnesota. I think the author, something like Shackle, might be his name. Anyways, this Lobdell basically says that as far as the dialogue interrupting the plot, as it were, or the narrative or the story or the images, that these sort of interruptions themselves make these chapters sort of short and feeling, he uses the word scrappy. And apparently scrappy chapters is also a quote from Lewis about another, maybe I think 18th century author, because that's the topic of Lobdell's paper. So Lewis apparently did not like whatever constituted these scrappy chapters for him. And the way that Lobdell is using it about Out of the Silent Planet is basically these sections of dialogue and plot, and they're short and they're quick. And it's like, why are we, you know, moving through a forest with the cross and then now beginning to talk about life and death or the Eldil, right? It seems basically he says that as far as these dialogues go, that and he's quoting Chad Walsh in another his essay in Longing for a Form. He's basically saying that philosophy could be the plot, right? Or could be said to be the plot, I think is what Lobdell says. And when I saw that, I'm like, oh, that's perfect. We have dialogue among narrative. We have somebody basically saying like, oh yeah, like this is philosophy functioning as a plot. And that was when I was doing my early readings and investigating the possibility of the Ransom Trilogy or the Cosmic Trilogy as spiritual exercise or as a form of philosophy. That was about all the invitation I needed to really do as much as I could to frame it in that way. And I thought as well, if I could take somebody who is viewing these middle chapters as sort of an interruption or scrappy, or perhaps not as developed in the form of we see the Chronicles of Narnia in its full literary form or at Lewis's literary masterwork, I wanted to basically take it as a challenge. Like if I could show people that instead of this being sort of a scrappy section or a section that's like, oh, we need to get through this so we can move on to, you know, visiting the Sorn after the village of the Hrossa, and we just need to get to the cool part where Ransom meets the Oryarsa, and we have this, you know, wild back and forth between, you know, Weston and the Oryarsa and Ransom translating and all of that, you know, like this is just, we just need to get through this part. And I wanted to take that as a challenge to show, actually, this is a core part. Like you can't have the end of the book without, especially these dialogues, without something that you might just flip through being like, oh, there's no new plot here, right? Like we're in the village, we're walking around, we're looking at nature, and you get some exciting things, of course, like the appearance of the Eldil, Ransom learning what it is, and the killing of the Nokra. Those are very important points, but you could essentially just flip through those dialogues and find those parts if you were just skimming it. And that, to me, would be then missing the spiritual benefit or the benefit for the exercise of the soul or the growth of one's ability to encounter God in the world, or one sense of wonder, to put it in those other ways. And so that was sort of what I wanted to show. I wanted to take these from scrappy chapters and show, in fact, these are probably some of the most important parts. And in some ways, I would argue actually even more important than the beginning scene, or the scene near the beginning, where Lewis encounters space as the heavens. I think that's just giving us a taste for what Ransom will more consistently perceive once he's gone through his own journey of spiritual exercise in the middle chapter. So I took it as a challenge. I thought it was a funny way of putting those chapters, and I wanted to just seize on that and show actually this is a great instance of where Lewis is using these principles of spiritual exercise and inviting us to journey along with Ransom.
Trevor, now that we've heard your paper, are there any other final helpful clarifications you think it would be helpful to share?
One thing to keep in mind about the paper as well, and what I'd like to try to show, is that the Ransom Trilogy or the Cosmic Trilogy itself is a part of Lewis's fiction that should be just as, or I would encourage people to enjoy just as much as the Chronicles of Narnia and appreciate at an aesthetic level, or the level that the way the text works, in the same way as the Chronicles of Narnia, that it is actually a coherent piece of fiction, which is a part of the debate, but also that it's not just a work on the way to the Chronicles of Narnia, that in its own merit or its own virtue, it is actually something that is worth being considered. It's something that's worth spending time on. It's something that should be people should encourage others to read just as much the Chronicles of Narnia for its delight in the description and the images, but also for the way that it uses these medieval and ancient tools for spiritual exercise. So that would be my main thing that I'd like people to take away from the text, is that in its own right, It is a piece of literature. It's an excellent piece of literature. It has its own coherence, and it's trying to do something specific like the Chronicles of Narnia are doing, but in a different genre and in a specific way of using those tools. And I would say, just to have a little bit of a caveat on that as well, and this would be why people would say that the texts are just on their way to the Chronicles of Narnia. The use of these tools for spiritual exercise, Lewis is translating them more directly from their historical circumstances into the present. And I think that's why people can often feel like the text is clunky or harder to read, or, and I think it does, because it is spiritual exercise and exercise is demanding, that it demands more of the reader. And for somebody who's just skimming the text, which I would encourage readers not to do, it might not have a lot in the, by the way of plot necessarily, because as Lobdell was saying, or as I brought up about Lobdell, that philosophy could be said to be the plot. And if we sit with these images, if we pay attention to what the text is bringing up in us, that that can help us enjoy the text in a way that is deeper, more engaging, and I think induces a sense of wonder much more than if we treat it just as another novel, especially a novel that is just working within the modern, you know, modern literary age, or its modern literary ages, as opposed to how one might read in a medieval context. So I hope, along with Lewis's own works, to invite readers into this different way of reading, into a slower way of reading, and into a way of reading that is trying to listen to the text and to hear the text by way of noticing what the text is doing in oneself.
Trevor, where can we go to find out more about you and about your work, I guess, particularly in this area?
Absolutely. The best place to find my work at this moment is on my academia.edu page. So if listeners Google my name with academia.edu, then they will see a list of papers I have on similar topics, applying the Middle Ages to learning with digital technology. And I have an essay on meditating on Tolkien's Leif by Nidigal to learn what we can see about students' vocation and calling and in present education, and as well as the paper that I gave at the Lewis conference. That would be the best place to find me. As far as diving into this work, Jason Baxter's book on Lewis in the Middle Ages, I think, is an excellent introduction to how Lewis engages with his sources and how he's learning from them and how he's trying to use them in his fiction. I think, as far as if readers could just read one book that it would invite them further into that, that would be the place to go. And I think, again, the best way to get into this type of reading and research is to experience it yourself. And I think, again, the Ransom Trilogy, that's part of why I wrote my paper on it, is I think is a great way to introduce yourself to this type of reading, to this way of doing philosophy.
Trevor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @PremierUnbelievableFE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @Premier.Unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.